Welcome, market participants, to another episode of Leading Voices in Credit, our monthly podcast here at KBRA that presents some of the most relevant perspectives in credit markets. I'm joined today by David Knudsen, Senior Investment Director at Schroders, the global asset manager based in London. David has been a senior institutional fixed income investor for 20 years, and he also has experience as a debt capital markets banker. David is also chair of the Credit Roundtable, a leading bondholder advocacy group that counts 39 institutions as members that have collectively some $4 trillion of fixed income assets under management. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Ben. Happy to be here.
So let's kick things off with something I touched on in my podcast, Three Things in Credit. It's an observation of a strategist who lamented that macro uncertainty is incredibly high. People have no idea what 2024 looks like, from inflation to the labor market to geopolitics to political dysfunction. What does 2024 look like to you?
So I think 2024 is going to be a year remembered as a time of transition. You're seeing, as you talked about in your podcast, you're seeing generational changes in labor markets. You're seeing technology that we have never seen before. By the way, I was reading today that the newest version of ChatGPT can pass level one and level two of the CFA exam, which, yeah, so for everyone out there that's looking at that exam this December or next June. But it's going to be disruptive, and we're going to restructure energy with green policies. We're looking at unprecedented fiscal spending and imbalances. So I guess I break it down into a simple way to remember, and I think I'm going to call it the 3D reset: deglobalization, decarbonization, and demographics, all going to change. And we're looking at that at the same time we're looking at the rate volatility that I think very few people have experienced in their careers.
Yeah, interesting. So it sounds to me like that sets up for you to be defensive. And yet, if we think about some of these things, they are clearly moving, and we share a lot of those concerns, I think, with you. But how do you think about that in terms of, I guess, knowing that it's not going to hit all at once? Are you more defensive going into 2024 in anticipation of some of these changes? Or is it just sort of worth riding what might be a soft landing? How do you think through that dynamic?
So I think zero interest rates lowered the intelligence of borrowers and lenders, generally speaking. And you look at the last 15 years, and you've seen business models, you've seen companies that have all relied on abundant and cheap liquidity. And in the natural history of the markets, that's just not the way it usually works. So I think there's going to be disruptions. So with that in mind, I think it's very important to have dry powder and be ready to seize those moments. Those moments can be very short-lived. We saw recently the 10-year touch 5% and then violently come back down. And we're going to see those kinds of things in the markets. And it's hard to say exactly where the disruption will manifest. But generally speaking, from being in the markets for a long time, you look to those parts of the market that grew the fastest in recent history.
Yeah, I think that's all good color. You know, in terms of resetting out of this zero interest rate policy into something that's more normal, we've talked and thought a lot about that. We refer to it really as a new paradigm here in credit, which, again, if you've just joined our fixed income world in the last 15 years, this is not something that you're terribly familiar with. But for more experienced folks like ourselves, you know, this return to normal brings with it the expectation, I think, that it's going to be tougher to earn an acceptable return. You know, companies are going to face all of those things you've talked about, those three Ds. Does that imply kind of a reset or a flushing out of zombie companies in 2024 and 2025? How do you think about all of that as it presents itself with default rates, for example?
Yeah, so default rates right now, or if you look at the high yield and leveraged loan market, I think are around 5%. They're going to go up next year, but there's still residual liquidity sloshing around out there. At transitional points, people tend to embrace the narrative that fits them or is most comfortable. And bond analysts or, you know, fixed income investors we are a sad bunch of people. And it pays off to assume or to look at things more critically or to challenge those views. So I think that's something that we've seen recently in the markets, given the slightly less treasury refunding and the slightly, you know, weaker employment data. The markets come back pretty strong. But it really brought out, speaking of zombies, it brought out issuers today that probably could not have accessed the market, you know, a week or two ago. So zombie harvesting requires a healthy banking system. And what we have in the United States is a healthy banking system. Now, I know I'm going to be challenged on that because it wasn't more than, you know, 6 months ago that we were all worried that banks were going to fall and fail. But I'm here to tell you that the banking system here is a lot stronger than it was pre-global financial crisis, or frankly, any other time in my career.
Yeah. So I may take exception with you labeling me and maybe us as sad, but I think we are probably, as fixed income folk, trained to try and think through some of those more downbeat scenarios. One of the things that's caught my eye is that, notwithstanding all of the things you talked about, and my belief that, and a reminder that economic growth tends to trough after the last Fed rate hike, right? So in other words, that trough is in front of us. If I look at where consensus earnings expectations are, say in the S&P 500 from our not so sad folks over on the equity side, they're calling for double digit growth. Is that something that you think is possible? Which again would suggest a certain recovery expectation with that. But how do you think about what corporate earnings growth is going to look like in 2024?
So I really think that when you look at what estimates are, and estimates are always optimistic at the beginning of the year, so we take that with a little bit of grain of salt, but I wouldn't be surprised if they come in, you know, this time next year, if we do this again, I wouldn't be surprised if they're half of what they are today. And the reason why is rates are high. There's 5% more. And it doesn't matter if you're financing a credit card or an auto loan or a house. But if you look at like small business, these guys are getting crushed. And the reason why maybe it's harder for Wall Street to fully appreciate this is because these mom and pop businesses are not in our market accessing capital. They are accessing it from these community banks. And those community banks are also getting crushed. And that's half of the employment in the United States. You're talking about auto payments have gone up, credit card payments, I think I've already talked about, commercial small size businesses, you know, paying kind of in the low teens. That is just going to shrink margins. It's going to ultimately, they're going to maybe push price a little bit or reduce demand. It'll destroy demand. And these companies are going to have to be rationalized.
Yeah, no, I hear you on all of those points. So give me some, let's tap into your perspective you could have broadly at Schroeder's. And when you think about, I know you predominantly look at credit in the U.S. There are probably plenty of Yankee issuers that might come across your radar as well. But how do you think about sort of the global impact in the U.S. or in credit markets, things that have come out of possible European recession, China slowing? How are you thinking about some of those geopolitical or overseas factors that might ultimately influence the way credit performs here in the States?
So I think there's probably three really important things to focus on when we're talking about the broader macro factors. And I think maybe the most obvious is oil. You look back over our careers and our lives, maybe better said, but you're looking at times when conflict in the Middle East erupted and oil prices popped, doubled, went up four times. I think the lowest they went up was when Iraq and Kuwait went to war. But these all provoke very difficult environments for credit here in the United States, recessions in some cases. So I think oil is one of those things that we need to be sensitive to, given the current conflict that's going on in the Eastern Mediterranean. So the other thing is probably less appreciated, and it's been the widowmaker trade to short yen or short JGBs or Japanese government bonds. But the Bank of Japan is facing unprecedented inflation pressures. And they've already loosened a bit their control over their rate market, but you could see additional loosening of their yield curve control. And why is that important? Well, Japan owns 15% of the treasury market. And in our markets, or in markets in general, this marginal buyer, or a marginal buyer, can have a profound impact on price. And when you add in the fact that China is probably buying less treasuries than it did in the past, given the slowdown in China, and you're also seeing banks, US banks, buying less, and even the Fed. So you have all these, what I would consider non-economic buyers, buying less. They were buying treasuries, sovereign wealth funds were buying treasuries to store wealth or store capital or regulatory reasons. And now you have to replace all that with economic buyers. I don't know where the bid is, but it's higher. An economic buyer requires more than an uneconomic buyer. And so second concern is Bank of Japan. The third one, I think, is commercial real estate. And there's an adjustment there that needs to be taken. And this will occur over time. I don't think it'll be a crisis, but it is something that needs to be processed.
Yeah. No, I think we share a lot of those concerns, whether it's on the rates market, the volatility associated with that, the fluidity of how a lot of those things are changing, are certainly something that we think about in terms of how it affects global fund flows, for sure. Let's delve into the world of banking just a little bit more. If I go back to the so-called March events, where you had the failure of some good-sized U.S. banks along with Credit Suisse, you know, some market observers at the time thought that the Credit Suisse event in particular would put an end to the AT1 market. How do you think about that? Did the Credit Suisse event change the way you think about that market or your participation in it?
So in general, I don't think there are bad securities, just bad prices. I will make an exception with the concept of a security that is subordinate equity. And what I mean by that is, if I can lose my money, get zeroed out as a creditor, while an equity, a residual or variable return person, can still maintain value, that's inconceivable. And that's impossible to price, in my opinion. The AT1 market has come back pretty strongly after Credit Suisse. And I think in some ways, you know, I look at how humans evolved to fear snakes. We would reach for additional food as folks reach for additional yield in the AT1 market. And over millions of years, we gradually developed something in our DNA to protect us from snakes. And I think we are still very early on in our conditioning for the AT1 market, if it works as promised. Now, it's always possible the regulators are going to come to our aid and there'll be a put somewhere, but the AT1 market as designed is going to wipe people out. And I think it'll take a few more Credit Suisses before that is fully appreciated. But the market should price somewhere between subordinated debt and equity. And if it does, well, then there's a place for it.
Yeah. You know, we've long thought about how you think about the opportunity set over the last 15 years, right? Where that ultra low rate environment really not only encouraged, but really demanded investors search for yield. And so you'll entertain all sorts of things in order to sort of book that yield. Today, it seems to me like you can put together, you know, a 6.5, 7, 7.5% investment grade portfolio fairly easily without having to really reach for yield. Is that something that you think is true? Is it getting more difficult as the soft landing narrative sort of takes root?
Yeah, there's somewhere around $5.5 trillion dry powder sitting in short bills and money market funds. And the reality is, at this transitional point, why would you take on more duration risk or credit risk, liquidity risk, subordination risk, you name it? In fact, in many cases, you get paid less given the shape of the curve and so on. So the liquidity that we've seen over the last 15 years has pushed people out of their natural habitats. And when I think about risks to fixed income investors, I always think about like the words that when you hear them, should make you shudder as a credit investor. Words like enhanced or engineering or synthetic or special purpose, those words are not good for credit investors. And so the more complex a security is or a bond is, the more uncomfortable or the more yield or requirement that I need.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Let's wrap up. Just, I want you to touch on the work you do at Credit Roundtable. Give us an idea of what the mission is of the group and maybe a couple of things that you're working on right now.
Sure. So the Credit Roundtable started in 2007 or so. It was a handful of people that essentially got together in the face of an aggressive corporate action. And it was a group of REIT analysts that basically said no. And the transaction essentially used a device at pitting short-term or shorter duration investors against longer duration investors. But the reality was most firms owned credit across the spectrum. So you were literally robbing Peter to pay Paul from your own firm. And it didn't make any sense. And so there was a bondholder group that started and it turned out very favorably for creditors. And then the Credit Roundtable started. And so the Credit Roundtable focuses on corporate actions. It focuses on underwriting and distribution and covenants. And recently we've been working with responding to the FDIC regarding their long-term debt request for comment. I think particularly concerning to members with regards to that specific working group is the minimum denomination that's being proposed. We're also working closely with a variety of industry groups regarding some proposed legislation in the New York Assembly on sovereign debt. Essentially, this proposed legislation would make it more challenging or more difficult to recover or to negotiate in a sovereign restructuring. You know, we worked very closely with the Fed and the ARC on LIBOR. That was a multi-year project. And then there's been several bondholder groups that we've worked on. We're affiliated with a law firm and a financial advisor that help us to organize some of those things. So we have our semi-annual meeting coming up. So we're going to be talking about climate and how it impacts real estate and risk and returns. We also have speakers that are going to talk about ESG and some of the challenges with that and labor. This whole idea of the deglobalization or demographics, labor versus capital.
Terrific. And where can people find out more information? I assume on the website.
Yeah, creditroundtable.org is the best place to go. You can, I think there's a way to contact us through the website.
Terrific. Well, let's leave it at that. And an awful lot to talk about, not all of which was sad. David, thanks for your time today and happy investing.
Thank you very much, man. Take care.
Thanks for listening to our latest Leading Voices in Credit podcast. Make sure you tune in every month for a new episode. And don't forget to tune in weekly for our Three Things in Credit episode. Happy listening. Hello, listeners. Join me, Van Hesser, KBRA's chief strategist, and thousands of listeners each Friday for the latest episode of my Three Things in Credit podcast, where I reveal three things in credit markets that you should know about. That's Van Hesser's Three Things in Credit. Subscribe now.